Nokia Podcast Episode Number 41.
We conclude our musical month with Mr. James Catchpole from the Tokyo Jazz Site, who gives us an insight into the cool jazz cafes here in Japan. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. Coming to you from a very hot and humid Japan. We are in the height of the summer season right now, and it is toasty here. I believe I saw it was 38 degrees in Saitama last week, which is hot. Here in Tokyo, it's not so bad. It's about 30, 32 degrees, about 90 degrees if you're using the American system. But whatever system you use, it is definitely humid here in Japan. You know, before I came to Japan, many people had kind of warned me and scared me about the Japanese summer. They told me that it's a concrete jungle in Tokyo and it's really hot. But I gotta say, I don't find it to be that much hotter than when I was living in Bangkok. And maybe a couple years in Bangkok, I acclimatized my body to the temperature, but it's not as bad as I thought. The biggest difference I noticed between Tokyo and Bangkok is that in Tokyo, you do a hell of a lot more walking than I ever did in Bangkok. In Bangkok, the best way to beat the heat is just never walk outside in it. If you think you can make it, you know, you got to go down the street or you got to go across the street to another office or something, you think you can make it, wrong. What happens is you get out there for the first couple minutes, you're fine. And then right about when you get to your destination, bam, the heat gets you and you start sweating like crazy and you go inside and you're just a sweating mess. So in Bangkok, the secret is just call a taxi. Even a motorcycle taxi will keep you cool because the air is flowing over you, you know, so you don't do a lot of walking there. Here in Japan is the opposite. You do a heck of a lot of walking. You walk everywhere. You walk to the train station. You walk in the train station. And so it's difficult to get away from the heat here. The other problem with dealing with the heat in Japan is trying to figure out how to use your air conditioning unit. Now, of course, if you're Japanese and listening to this, or you can read Japanese, this is not a problem for you because you just pick it up, read all the kanji that's on the remote control, and no problem. But for those of us who are not quite as adept at reading the kanji, it actually can be quite confusing to figure out how to operate your air conditioning unit. Because being that this is Japan, the air conditioner doesn't just have AC. It has AC, it has a heater built into it, has a dehumidifier built into it, and some of them even have a laundry mode that dries your clothes somehow, and I have no idea how that works. But being in Japan here, everything has to have multiple functions, and multiple functions mean multiple buttons, and all those buttons are in kanji. So if you can't read the kanji and you're not so great at the kanji, then really the last thing you want to do is turn on your heater when you're trying to turn on your air conditioning unit. So if kanji is not your strong point, visit my good friend Ashley's website at survivinginjapan.com because she has an excellent, excellent post about how to use an air conditioner in Japan, where she breaks down the typical kanji that you find on a remote and translates it into English. So you can figure out which is air conditioning, which is heater mode, which is high power or swingu, swing function, which is laundry mode, energy saving mode, strength of the airflow, all this kind of stuff. Ashley breaks it down into English. So grab your remote and try to match the kanji up to it and hopefully you can cool down as well. Well, New York is the place to go for jazz musicians. When it comes to jazz fans, it doesn't get any better than Tokyo. These are the words of Mr. James Catchpole, who runs the website tokyojazzsite.com. Originally from Brooklyn, James has been in Japan for 13 years and has spent the last 5 years carefully researching and profiling many of the great jazz-related establishments here in Greater Tokyo. He joins me today to talk about jazz in Japan. Hey, James, welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Thanks a lot.
So, before we get started, can you tell us, as the audience can probably hear, we are not in my Tokyo Podcast studio because I don't have jazz music. but Tell us about this place that we're in here today.
Sure. Well, we're sitting in the Samurai Cafe, Samurai Cafe Bar in Shinjuku, just a couple of minutes from Shinjuku Station. And this is one of the older places still remaining from the jazz heyday in Tokyo. Shinjuku used to have about maybe upwards of 30 or 40 of these kind of cafes, what they call jazz kisaten in Japanese. And, you know, slowly over the years, a lot of them closed. You know, society changed. People started buying records that they could listen to at home, listening to Walkmans, now downloading music. You know, the sort of communal listening experience slowly faded away. But a couple of the older places are still here. And Miyazaki-san, the owner here, he's been here now 33 years, I think. And as you can see, sitting around us, the decor here is really quite unique. It's one of the more interesting spots in Tokyo. He collects Manneki Neko, which are the little lucky cats that you see. People listening in America or Canada know that from the Chinese restaurants. You always see a little cat.
Right, the little cat that's out front with the paw that's right, beckoning the customers
in. It's always
in.
Telling you to come in, right? So when you come into the Samurai, you immediately see that he's got about 3,000 of them scattered around. And anywhere from, you know, the size of a pen to the guy who's right behind you, who's about 7 feet tall.
You know what's kind of interesting about this place is that when we came in here, it's too bad this is audio because you already can't see it. You know, I'll take some pictures and post them on my Twitter page. But this kind of is exactly how I imagined a jazz bar to look. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of dark and... Obviously, I didn't expect to have cats everywhere, but this is, you know, they've got these like Jack Daniels bottles in the corner, and it's just kind of got this really funky, kind of cozy feel to it.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's one of the impressions that, you know, I bring a lot of foreign tourists who, you know, jazz fans contact me and they say, hey, you know, take us around a couple places, bring them here, and they're almost immediately struck with the same kind of feeling, like, oh, you know, this is what I imagined a Tokyo jazz joint would be like, because you got the combination of, you know, you've got John Coltrane on the wall, you've got the record albums that he has, he changes monthly featuring different artists, but you've also got all of these, you know, Japanese, Chinese, Indian figurines, Buddhist scripture, scrolls, a lot of religious figurines, and all the lucky cats spread around. So you get that sort of odd mix of Asia and jazz coming from the States. And I think people, you know, especially the tourists who just arrived, they're really drawn to it.
Yeah, I really like this place a lot. So actually what we've done is we've invited the owner, Mr. Miyazaki-san, to come join us and talk about his bar. What attracted him to the jazz world in the first place?
私あまり音楽ミュージックよくなんで特別ジャンルにねあのなんていうかなこう好きになった音楽があまりなかったのね、まあ、テレビとかラジオとかそういう自然に、まあ、受け身受動的に、ね、聞いてきたで自分が積極的にね聞くようになって初めて、新宿でジャズ喫茶でジャズ聞いてね、好きになったその理由ですよね、あの人が歌ってる音楽じゃないのね、楽器、インストルメンタルのが中心になって、しかも非常に質素地味、あのファッションも非常にあのなんていうかシンプルでね、なんていうかな本当に音だけが楽器の音、歌は人の声だから言葉がメッセージです。ジャズの場合は。
So he's saying that you know when he's younger he wasn't really a fan of any kind of music at all. Actually, he came to Tokyo. Miyazaki-san was a Gunma citizen. He came from Gunma Prefecture, which is more of a quite rural place, and then came to Shinjuku area and went to the jazz cafe, jazz kisaten, and started hearing the records for the first time, and was kind of drawn to it that it wasn't you know he was listening to a lot of instrumental jazz mostly and that you know rather than the emotion coming through words it was coming just through the instruments and the sound just that the purity of the sound just boom you know hit him and the kind of purity of the style, I guess you'd say. He liked the fact that it wasn't so much about the way the guys looked or anything. I'm not sure. I think they were pretty styling back then. But yeah, I mean, you know, you could see what he was looking at these guys just wearing plain suits and just getting up there and blowing. And that sound just hit him. And from then he became a jazz fan.
Wow, cool. To me, it seems listening to jazz is kind of a laid-back, mellower mode, right? How does he feel about the hustle and bustle of Tokyo?
So he says, you know, first of all, jazz kisaten is an oasis. That's what he says. You know, it's a place you come in, and it's a space. It's a completely, almost hermetically sealed space where you don't really exist in the rest of the city. And he said, you know, back in those days in the 60s, a lot of new music was coming out all around the world, in America and Japan, folk movement, rock movement, blues and everything, which he dug. But jazz was something you weren't hearing anywhere else except in these environments at that time. So it wasn't on TV so much. You didn't hear it in the commercials. It wasn't necessarily like a trendy thing. It was almost like, you know, he's saying, college students used to come. They were the main customers, you know, in his age group and in the late 60s or whatever. And they'd come to the cafes and listen to it. And this was like sort of their space where they could listen.
Oh, cool. Like the kind of like the speakeasies during the Prohibition era in America, right? It's kind of separate from everybody else.
Kakuren mitaina tokuro desu ne. So. Like a hidden space, you know?
You know, Miyazaki-san said something very interesting in that. He said that he enjoyed the early days when he was young, where it was just a bunch of guys playing. Didn't matter what they look like. Didn't matter what kind of clothes they were wearing. It's all about kind of the purity of the music. And I think many people our age and perhaps older would agree that music has changed a lot in the last few years. And you know, maybe not always for the better. It's become a lot more manufactured, a lot slicker. The artists have certainly gotten a lot prettier. Has jazz made that transition, or is it still retained a lot of its traditional roots?
I think it already went through that transition, and it went through in the 70s and then in the 1980s. But starting in the 70s, but you know, people have been saying, since the late 50s, jazz is dying, you know. Certain elements have said that because it's never gonna have a place in the public, at least in the United States, right, in North American context, that it once did, where it was popular music, that everybody got dressed up looking sharp on a Friday night and went out swing dancing.
Well, when was the heyday for that? 20s and 30s?
Well, that would have been, up until in the 40s, basically.
Right, okay,
But then in the 50s, it shifted from being dance music, solely dance music, to being music you actually went to the club and listened to, because it became, it just became more, for lack of a better word, it became more arty, you know what I mean? And it was music that was considered deeper, and the critics loved it. But still, in that heyday, you had several dozen jazz clubs in New York. You had 15 clubs on 52nd Street alone, right? They're all gone, you know what I mean? And you know, rock and roll, for whatever its good and bad points, you know, helped to wipe that out. And, you know, jazz today is, I think, 2% of the CD's sale, the market, you right, know? Right. Maybe 2%. Right. I mean, it's less than American country music, right. by far, which is really shocking and depressing. So in a sense, that already happened. But, you know, you have... Today you have the genre called smooth jazz, which was kind of created in the 80s, which is pretty much just background music, rhythmically simple, quite, for real jazz fans, really boring music, but it sells. And it's classified as jazz in the record store.
Right, right.
And it sells big in the concerts. You know, people like Kenny G, right?
Right, right.
You know, I mean, any real jazz fan can't stand Kenny G. You know,
right.
He's the Antichrist.
Right,
but,
right.
But look how many millions of records he sold.
Some people call it elevator music.
It's at that level, man. Yeah, for sure. But you still have a lot of great musicians, and you have enough jazz festivals, and the fans are loyal enough that it's going to maintain its small but solid level of popularity. And because of that, you have musicians doing great work. And, you know, obviously the advent of things like YouTube, social media has meant that more and more diverse people are collaborating, exposing music that you would never see normally. I mean, I've seen music from, you know, Central Asia. I've seen jazz bands from Brazil, all online, and it's great stuff, you know. And I forget who it was who said it. It was maybe it was Marcus Miller. Somebody said when a reviewer asked him, like, you know, well, are you just regurgitating all the great masters like Miles and Coltrane? He's like, man, I'm not just making fries up here, you know. I'm making new music, and okay, maybe I'm not going to reach the level of fame and legendary status that the jazz giants did, you know, but they're still out there working hard. So, but you know, it is tough. There's a lot of commercial pressures on musicians. You know, I mean, you hear a lot of people having to take day jobs just because they can't make a living with the music they want to make.
Right.
You know. And it looks like that's going to be continued to beat away. It's very, from what musicians tell me, it's harder to be a gigging musician now than it was, you know, 30, 40 years ago.
Right. Yeah. I've heard that too. You know, I think it's hard to keep your original music. You know, if people, producers see dollar signs, and they think they can make money off you, it's, they push you in one direction. And, sure. And I mean, anyone who turns on the radio now, I mean, I haven't listened to radio in years, but you cannot tell me that there's a lot of difference between the pop songs that you hear.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. That's just really mass-produced stuff.
It's
you know?
Like McDonald's of music.
Completely,
you know?
Yeah. Well, that's the great thing, you know, in the jazz world, you know, you got a lot of people doing, you know, the new collaborative stuff, world music collaborations and stuff, and they're getting their music out there on their websites, right. On YouTube, you know, whether they make a living or not, I don't really know, but as a fan, it's a great time,
right.
You know, I have access to more music than I could ever possibly imagined or I could ever listen to in my lifetime.
It's interesting then that for these artists, the internet and YouTube and some of these other peer sharing sites have actually been beneficial to them in getting their music out there.
Yeah.
Whereas some of these pop artists, you know, they're really trying to shut it down.
Yeah, yeah. I think, well, you know, because they're operating on such a different level. I mean, you know, I don't know what the average jazz record sells, but it's pretty low numbers, right? Even you know, the number one record on the jazz chart, how many records is that compared to a successful pop or R&B record? It's pretty slim. But then again, these guys, you know, I know guys who've been able to make their career, and they get to travel the world, they play gigs, and a friend of mine in New York, he in the last couple of years he's played in Japan, he played in Portugal, and he just wrapped up a tour in Brazil. And, you know, he's not a household name. He's
right,
not world famous.
Right, right.
He's making a living.
But he's making a living.
And the great thing is he's bringing his music, you know? I mean, he said he made the choice a few years back. He didn't want to compromise. And, you know, he paid the price for that financially. But he's put in the hours, and now he's getting a tour of the world with his music. And that's really great, you know?
Right. And that's what it's all about, really, if you think about it. You know, like, you know, you and I were just talking that the 25 years ago, Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses came out. And I find it hard to imagine any popular pop music now that anybody will be listening to in another 25 years.
Yeah, for sure. And you know what? I also think that, like, I can't... Maybe we're too old, man. But, you know, I remember when we were that age, how big that record was, you know? I mean, like,
everybody. It was like a big thing, you know, to listen to it, to get a copy of it on tape. This
is before the internet.
Yeah.
For all your kids, there was a time before internet.
That's right.
Where you had you and your buddy had like one of those ghetto blasters that had two tape sets, you know.
Or you used to go to your friend's house who had cable and watch MTV so you could watch a video together, you know.
Right.
And I can't imagine in this day with so much choice and so much access, like could anything be that big, you know? That everybody that would groove to, you know, one record, because it's just so much choice now, and there's so many albums being released. That, I mean, that just feels like that was a different era. Yeah.
Now, can you tell me? I freely admit that I know very little about jazz. What's the history of jazz in Japan? Who brought it here?
Well, you know, it's funny. Most people, and I was the same actually when I first got to Tokyo. I assumed that jazz and baseball, my two biggest passions,
from New York,
of course. New York, yeah. You know, I kind of assumed, like most people, that they came after the war. You know, I mean, the Americans occupied Japan for 7 years, and the soldiers brought all this. And I found out pretty quickly, actually, that was not true. Both jazz and baseball came before the war, way before, actually. Pretty much for jazz, during the initial Dixieland period in America, which was the 1920s, Louis Armstrong, Sidney Bechet, that period, and when 78 records, 78, so were just being released, they almost immediately found their way over here. You know, people who, there was a lot of trading going on back then of Japanese who were going to America and vice versa. And, you know, then the swing era, which came in before the war, was very popular here. I mean, you had swing halls, dance halls, you know, in Ginza, down in the Ginza and Yorkshire area. And, you know, it was amazingly popular. And in fact, the first jazz cafe in Japan opened, I think it was 1927. I'd have to double check that day, but 1926 or 7 in Yokohama. And that was a place called Chigusa. And the story has it that, you know, as Japan became more militarized and quite anti-American, the authorities started closing these places down. You know, this was the degenerate music. It was African-American, it was black. And they didn't like that. And so the owner of the Chigusa Cafe, the story has it is that he buried all his records in his front garden. So when the authorities came, they wouldn't take them and burn them. And that the day after the war ended, he dug them up, went down the street and reopened his cafe. You know, it may be apocryphal, but I mean, it kind of shows that even at that period, there was a mania for collecting and for listening to jazz in Japan. And that from the day the war ended, pretty much picked up.
Wow. Oh, interesting. Are there any... You know, obviously, in America, there are lots of famous jazz musicians. With jazz being so popular in Japan for so long, has it produced world-famous jazz musicians?
Sure. They have? Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I think probably the two most famous would be Akiyoshi Toshiko, who she's a pianist and composer. She had moved to America in the late 50s, I think. And, you know, it was interesting. I mean, she was one of the first Japanese to go over, so she faced some... You know, I mean, probably you could say she faced some prejudice. Right. Oh, you know, Japanese, they can't swing. Asians can't swing, you know.
Right.
And, I mean, she was a woman.
Right.
And, I mean, a woman entering a predominantly male world. So facing the double barrel of sexism and racism, I mean, she was strong, you know. And she persevered and as it made her career in America. You also have Watanabe Sadao, who is, I would believe, late 70s now. I don't know if he's playing anymore. He's had some health troubles, but he became pretty world famous in the 1960s. And even, say, on a tier lower level than that, musicians who were maybe only famous in the jazz world, but, I mean, easily, you know, several dozen, you know, touring in America, collaborating with very famous jazz musicians, and then you know, coming back here to continue their careers. So easily the equal of, you know, you could say France or say Italy or Poland, from some European countries.
Which country is kind of known as the jazz country? Is it America?
Well, I mean, you know,
like, of course, every country has their own thing, but the origins, kind of like
definitely in America. I mean,
is it America?
I mean, America is the birthplace of jazz, and has produced the majority of, you know, the most famous musicians and recordings. But, you know, the beauty of the music is, like a lot of wonderful things in the United States, it's a hodgepodge, it's a mixture of different influences, but predominantly being, you know, a Black American music art form. It's an African American music art form, but that has now been exported around the world, so that you can go to a city, you can go to Krakow in Poland, or you can go to Uzbekistan, or you can go to Johannesburg, and you're going to hear live jazz played by locals there, and it's going to swing, and you're going to dig it, you know. And none of these people may have even been to the United States, but the music has been embraced around the world, and you know, people been able to add their own little wrinkles to it, and the Japanese have done that completely.
Is there any difference between Japanese produced jazz and American jazz?
You know, I mean, there used to be a lot of you know, light criticism that the Japanese were technically proficient, but they couldn't swing. Again, there's a little bit of coded, coded racial attitudes. I don't think that really exists anymore. I mean, generally, you know, you can play, and there's some differences in terms of the audiences' expectations. I think, you know, like a lot of the Japanese audiences are very into their standards, what we call standards, like the more famous songs that you hear musicians cover again and again. And if you go to a live gig of a Japanese group, a mainstream group, you can pretty much predict exactly what they're going to play. Right. Yeah. And so some of the visiting musicians like, yeah, man, that's a little bit square, but, you know. But that's at like a mainstream club, you know. I mean, you also have a really thriving avant-garde scene here, very experimental scene too. Those two worlds are kind of separate, though.
Okay. One thing you mentioned a little bit earlier, which I kind of wanted to touch on, was about technology. And, you know, in the last few years, music has shifted a lot from analog to digital. Has jazz made that transition as well?
Well, sure. I mean, a lot of the new albums, CDs, you know, recorded digitally, of course. But
I mean, is if you came to a bar like this, would he put a CD in the CD player, or... Is it the vinyl that still gives it the soul and the quality?
I see what you mean. Yeah.
Does it transition to digital format well?
Well, I think a lot. There's definitely a lot of obsession with analog vinyl,
right?
In this world,
right.
in this sort of jazz bar, jazz cafe world, right. You know, these guys are collecting mostly vinyl, yeah, and some of them, you know, it depends on their personality, their age. Some of them are, you know, have some CDs, but you'll hear grumbling about like, it doesn't sound good, you know, or something like that. And I mean, when you look at the care that they take of their turntable and how they take care of their albums, you know, you can tell that they are digging the vinyl sound. And that's an analog sound.
I was kind of wondering about that. I had a friend of mine back in Vancouver who owned a record store, Scratch Records, and I was astonished at how busy he still was. I mean, his store was always packed, people just, you know, rifling through. And you would kind of think in this digital age where you can download anything to your iPod, that vinyl would have... I mean, vinyl predates cassettes, you know? Like, you know, who buys cassettes nowadays,
yeah, right? Right.
But there is something about vinyl and that listening to music that gives it kind of this warmth that you don't kind of get with it.
I think there's two things. I mean, you know, for me, my ear is actually probably not... I don't think it's as good as some people who are like audiophiles, you know, who, I mean, they can pinpoint the difference between speakers when you're in the shop. I can't really do that, but you can definitely hear a sort of a bottom, a sort of a depth, when you hear vinyl on a good system. And you know, yeah, I mean, when you come to cafe and he puts on a record, an original pressing, and cranks the volume up a bit, and you think, well, you know, I've heard this record so many times on CD with my headphones, but I've never heard it like this. It's such a radically different experience. And and you know, man, those guys groove on that. You know, I mean, they really dig it. You know, when you tell them, like, oh man, this sounds really good. You know, and they take pride in it. I mean, one guy was telling me he put his speaker system together himself, went on a long soliloquy about all the parts he used, getting quite technical. I don't know this stuff in English.
Right.
So in Japanese, you know, he lost me after about 30 seconds, but he wanted to share it with me. And he went on, you know, about 5-10 minutes talking about how he put his sound system together to get that perfect, perfect environment in his cafe. And I was like, wow, that's very impressive. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm sure that many people listening to this want to know, what are some of your favorite jazz bars? If you could give us the top three, ambience, music, everything, what are they?
Okay, yeah, that's a tough one. I would say, well, you know, for a bar, not a club, right? So not for live music, just for, you know, listening to records and drinking. Definitely here would be one of the top places. This is the Samurai in Shinjuku. And the name is misleading because it's not related to what you think it is. It's a mystery. And I'll leave it to anyone who comes as a guest. If you look at the front door as you come in the bar, there's a postcard on the front door that will give away the meaning of the samurai.
So it's not the warrior.
It's not what you think.
Not what I think.
And,
okay.
And that's why it's not written in kanji characters. It's written in the katakana script.
Okay.
So for Japanese people, that immediately jumps out. Like,
right.
Why is it not written in the kanji? So,
okay.
But that's a kind of a hidden little.
Where is this place?
Joke. This is in Shinjuku, right near the southeast exit, 1 minute away. I recommend because he's got a great collection. He plays pretty much all genres, so you can hear experimental things, and maybe at night if it's really crowded he might put on a bit of softer stuff. He put on the Stan Getz right now for the background, so I think because we're recording, so nothing too, you know, dissonant. I would recommend for another real classic place that's very unique to Japan, I would say the Eigakan, which is in Hakusan Station on the Mita subway line. And Eigakan in Japanese means movie theater. Okay. So, why is it called Eigakan? I had to go check it out, right? People had been telling me about it. And the owner there, Yoshida-san, he used to be a documentary filmmaker. He was working in the film industry. And some point in the 70s, they found this space there, and that's not quite in the center of town, but it's pretty easy to get to. And they were doing some film showings there in the mid-70s, I guess. And then they started serving beer and, you know, and drinks while they would have a film showing twice a week in this empty space. And slowly, he transformed it into a jazz bar, because they were all, you know, jazz heads. But inside that place, you'll see a lot of record albums, but also tons of old film cameras, 16mm and 8mm, a lot of movie posters, and some wonderful books of, you know, photo books of old Japan movie houses from the 50s and 60s, along with the usual jazz books. So that's the kind of place where you could, you know, if you're a film fan and a music fan, which I am, that's a great spot. And definitely not the kind of place that you'd get overseas. I guess the third place would be, I'm going to cheat. I'm going to give you two more.
Okay.
The third place would be called Kisa Sakaiki. Kisa Sakaiki, which is in Yotsuya, right in the center of town. And that's a fairly new place. And the guy that owns it, Fukuchi-san, has basically taken the, you know, what the old jazz cafe culture was, but brought some new style to it. And he puts on a range of events, avant-garde type stuff, straight ahead stuff. He has a back room, he has listening parties, jazz club meetings. It's just a superb space to go if you're interested in art and music in Tokyo. And the fourth spot is another Shinjuku place called Jazz Pub Misho. Misho-san's 79 years old. Big fan of hard bop and soul jazz, which is kind of the more funky art, bluesy type jazz. So even non-jazz fans can dig that. It's not dissonant at all. Real groovy stuff, right? And he's got about 4,000 records, all vinyl, all originals that he bought from U.S. soldiers in the 50s
really?
And 60s. Yeah, wow. When records were very expensive here, he would get them to buy stuff from the PX, you know?
Right, right.
And if you want to hear some really rare albums that are going to make you, you know, make you really shake it, you go there. That's a tiny place. That's, again, only in Tokyo. It's 9 people could fit in there.
Nine people,
maybe nine. And if you were big, Western people maybe not even know. So, and Misho-san's a real treasure, you know. He turned 79 recently. He's still really genki. Would chat to you in Japanese. He wears a kimono, dances all night, drinks a lot, and that's one of the most unique, wonderful places that you're going to find in Tokyo. So could not recommend it more. Yeah.
And then I wanted to ask you, on your website, you mentioned that you sometimes take customers and clients to see clubs. So if someone's coming into town and perhaps they want to explore the Tokyo jazz scene, they can contact you, right? And what do you do? Do you have a tour that's set
yeah,
up?
Yeah, I do. I basically, you know, I leave it pretty open-ended. You know, people contact me when they're going to be in town. And then let me know, you know, ask them, let me know what it is they're interested in, because, you know, you get a wide range of people. I mean, I get some jazz fans who, you know, real maniac collectors, you know, and then they want to go to hidden, out-of-the-way record shops, and they just want to go shopping, you know, they don't even want to talk about anything, you know, or see any sights. I mean, they just want to hit the record stores and like, okay, that's cool, I'll take you there, that's what you want. You get other people who want to do a sort of a walk around the Shinjuku area, Tokyo, learn a little bit about the city and check out like a cafe and a bar on their tour. And so we do a walking tour.
Right.
And then you get people who want to, you know, it's like, okay, look, take me out to some dive jazz bars and, you know, drinks on me. And I'm like, great, yeah, that's fine. And so we'll make a night and we'll hit four places. People who want to go to live shows, I generally don't go with them just because, I mean, it gets really expensive, right. You know. And I would say, look, you know, you don't want to pay for a tour just to have me sit there with you at the gig. So I'll take you on the walking tour and show you the bars and cafes and the shops. And then I'll point out the good live joints. And depending on what your personal tastes are, I'll point you in the right direction. And then the next night or later that night, you can go catch whatever live gig you want. So that's how I generally structure that. But, you know, I leave it really open on the website because I want people to tell me, hey, you know, this is what I want to do.
Right.
And I'll structure the tour accordingly.
Right. Okay. That's great. And if people want to check out more about jazz in Tokyo, they can visit your website at tokyojazzsite.com, where not only you can book a tour, but you have also reviews of many other jazz places in Tokyo here. And thanks, James. Thanks for coming on the show. I really enjoyed it and learned a little bit more about jazz.
Cool, man. Thanks a lot, Anthony.
Thanks again to James for coming on the show and giving us an insight into jazz here in Tokyo. If you are interested in finding out more about his website, visit tokyojazzsite.com, where he has documented an extensive list of all the jazz bars, cafes, and nightclubs all over the city. If you are coming to Tokyo and you want a real insider's look into the jazz hotspots, I definitely recommend booking one of his walking tours. I want to thank all the musicians who came on the show this month for our musical month. We started off with Leona Tokutake, who gave us a look into the bluegrass music from Memphis, Tennessee. And if you haven't heard that interview, I mean, you got to check it out because her accent is adorable. When we talked to Seiyu Lee, who's a rising music songwriter, singer-songwriter from New Zealand, who last year started a challenge to herself to record and sing a new song on YouTube every day for 365 days. And she did it, so really amazing. Even some of the days where she was sick, she still managed to put out a YouTube video every single day. And she recently concluded her 365-day challenge with a special performance here in Tokyo. So check out Tokyo Podcast episode number 40 for my interview with Seiyu Lee, and I definitely recommend taking a look at her YouTube channel. And also don't forget to check out the Tokyo Podcast YouTube channel. Occasionally I do take my video camera out there and make some videos about my life here in Tokyo. I don't do as many videos as I would like, but there are definitely some videos on there about what I see in my daily life here. So check that out on YouTube at Tokyo Podcast. You can also visit my Facebook page at facebook.com/Tokyo Podcast. And if you have a comment, feedback, or you want to be on the show, send me a message through Twitter at Tokyo Podcast as well. That's it. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Anthony Joe, and talk to you next month. Bye-bye.